Take your Bibles, turn with me to Esther chapter 6. We're there. We are at that point in the book where those of you that have been asking me to let's get on with the hope, let's get out of the downer, let's start giving credit where credit is due, let's start leaving with smiles on our faces, we're there. And it's interesting also that God is bringing us to the same place in our midweek studies and refresh in our of how people actually change. Now, that study has been amazing. And thank you, by the way, those that have been attending that, for your emails and your comments and amazing opportunity that you've been seeing in there on how we actually do change. And at that study also, we are at the point of the cross. So we've looked at all the bad stuff. We're looking at the thorns. We're looking at the heat of life. We're being able to take a look and see where these emotions come from, and those emotions lead us back to what sits on our heart. And now we're at the cross in that study, and so the hope there is midweek, and now we're going to see it once again in our morning study beginning from here on into the end of Esther. So stand with me, if you will, as we read God's word, and beginning in verse 1 of chapter 6, this is what we read. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing's been done for him." And the king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'This, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning, with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." And may the Lord add his blessings to the reading of the word, and you may be seated. So let me try to recap real quick where we are in this study of Esther for those of you who haven't been here for the last several months and heard all of the messages leading up to it. The book of Esther is basically a narrative of one big story, and in that narrative is where we try to pull the theology out to be able to say, you know, exactly what is God trying to teach us here. It's a book where God isn't even mentioned. You don't see anything of divine interventions directly listed in this particular book. And so it takes an exegetical idea or what they call hermeneutics, good hermeneutics, to be able to look at it, to be able to pull out what is it that God is actually saying to us. And so I need to recap this narrative up to this particular point and where we're at with it. Esther has devised a plan, a subtle plan, to save her people. At least she hopes to be able to save her people, the Jews. Because Haman, who hates Mordecai, Esther's cousin, and he will not bow down to him because Haman is the second most powerful man in the country. Haman refuses to bow down to him. And so Haman has devised a plan to get the king, unknowingly, to sign off on a law that will destroy all of the Jews one particular day, the 13th day of Adar, which is approximately 1 year after this edict was signed, that they will all be destroyed that particular day and all of their goods plundered. It is signed law. The king isn't even aware of it. He's aware of the law, but he's not aware of all who that would involve at this particular time. Esther has been convinced by Mordecai, her cousin, that you need to take action. You need to step out of the confines of the palace and of everything that you know and hold comfortable here, and to be able to save your people, to be able to come up with a plan. And she's done that. She's very subtly begun to work a plan. And we saw last week how that plan began. She took life into her own hands, if you will, and came before the king unrequested, unsummoned. And the king shown her favor. And the threat of death upon her own life has been at least eased for the time being, because she was given the golden scepter. It was held out to her, and she was granted permission to enter to the king to make a request. And the king asked, "What is it? What is your request? I'll grant it. Whatever it is, just tell me. You're my queen." And she says very subtly, "Well, I come to a feast that I've prepared for you, and then I'll make my request known to you. You and your most powerful man in the country, Haman, are invited." And so that's where we're at. The feast has occurred. At least the first feast has occurred. And Haman goes home that night and amazing, begins to buff his own ego, begins to stroke the pride that is within him by telling his family and his friends all that has occurred to him and how wonderful he is and how everything has been laid at his feet and how he was the only one other than the king to be invited to this feast. And yet, he was full of anger at the same time because Mordecai would not bow down to him even that day when he left. And so his family and friends have given him a rather crude, yet very prideful and ego-boosting recourse to it, and that is build a gallows and hang Mordecai on it. You're the second most powerful man. The king will grant you whatever you want. Go and have Mordecai hanged upon a gallows. And remember, once again, this gallows is not the Old West gallows where the hangman's noose is hung and the floor is kicked out from underneath him after it's placed around his neck and his neck is stretched until dead. That's not the gallows of the Old Testament. The gallows of the Old Testament is nothing more than a wooden spike of which people are impaled on and left to die. That is what a gallows was during this particular time. And so, not only does his family tell him to have a gallows made and to have Mordecai hanged upon it after the king gives permission, but have a 75-foot stake made. You could easily do it on an 8-foot one, but no, you need to make a point here, Mordecai. This is all about you. You make a 75-foot one. And so he agrees and he runs out. He's having his desire, his lust for recognition fed by his family, and he takes their advice completely. What we see now, we're going to begin to pick this story up here in chapter 6. We see that the writer of Esther has really written into this some amazing suspense, I believe. Consider if you were reading the book of Esther for the very first time, being hidden from all the Sunday school teachings of it and the lessons from your Sunday school teachers in times past, but for the first time to sit down and read this book of Esther. There would be amazing suspense at every moment of this. And what we have right now is we have, wow, whew, Esther was given a brief reprieve, wasn't she? But the king still doesn't know she's part of that Jewish crew that's going to be killed. But what about Mordecai? I mean, here we have Haman running out and asking permission while he literally is having the gallows built. He wants to have permission from the king to hang Mordecai upon it. So where's Mordecai? He seems to be on the fast track to become shish kebab here very shortly, and it just seems that that's what is going to occur. That is what seems to be inevitable at this particular moment. It's all uncertain to us. We pick our story up in verse 3. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him says, "Nothing has been done for him." So while the work of building these gallows is literally going on outside the palace. There's something going on inside the palace. And it's insomnia. We're not able to sleep. That's where we're at with this story. The king just cannot sleep. There's no reason given here in the scripture, is there, for it? He didn't have a bad back. He didn't work real hard that day where he's achy. And he didn't eat special pizza that night, which was giving him indigestion. We don't see any reason for why he is not able to sleep. The very God who gives us the blessing of sleep has withheld the sleep from Haman, or from the king, this particular evening. And so what's he have done? He's going to have history books brought to him. Okay? Now, all you kids in high school, you know, for the most part, you need to fall asleep at night, have your parents bring a history book in and start reading it to you. Okay? You'll be asleep pretty quickly. Okay? It's not going to take too long until you're, okay, that's enough of that. Especially this history that doesn't mean a whole lot. Or history which you already know everything about. Like, the king does. What history does he have brought into him? This is your life, king. That's the chronicles of his life. That's what they're bringing in to read him. So the king is actually hearing, read to him, his life history. And it just so happens that the passage that they're beginning to read to him about, is about Mordecai saving his life. Now, if you go back to chapter 3 of Esther, you'll find that there is listed this story of Mordecai and how he saved the king's life by overhearing two of the guards out in front of the very threshold of just before entering into the king himself, the two guards there that were angry with the king and sought to kill the king. Mordecai overheard that, and Mordecai gets word through Esther back to the king about that. The king does his investigation, finds out that to be true, and bingo, gallows are made outside once again, and those two boys are hung on them. And so that's the story. Mordecai has saved the king's life. But it's interesting. Where does the king's mind go instantly to this? It's no small matter to the king when he recognizes there's nothing recorded in there as to what happened with Mordecai. How was he honored for saving my life? It's very important for us to understand that the Persian kings very much held in great esteem anybody that honored them. And something like this act of saving his life, would be greatly rewarded by a Persian king. Their safety depended upon it, didn't it? I need to have people out there watching my back because there's people out there to do me harm. And so if somebody does me good, I need to reward it. And so that was what was on the king's mind. And he says, what happened to Mordecai? What did we do for him? I mean, it doesn't have anything recorded here. Nothing. Nothing was done to him, king. We can't find anything recorded here. And so there's a sense of urgency that sets in with the king right away. We need to make sure that Mordecai is given some type of honor. Verse 4, and the king said, who's in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is out there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? You see what's happening? At the very moment, this is amazing, too, when you consider this is the wee hours of the morning when everybody is supposed to be asleep and in bed, when activity shouldn't be going on. But at the very wee hours of the morning, the king hears somebody in the outer court. And he asks who it is, and it turns out to be probably his most noble and trusted official at this particular time. It's Haman. Wow, what fortuitous luck is this? Haman's here to help me make up my mind. This is one of these kings that can't make up his own mind, as you've already seen since chapter 1. And so he has Haman come right in. He says, come on in, Haman, I need your help. Haman is so eager to take his wife and his friend's advice, to buff his ego, to serve the lust within his own heart for his own pride, that he didn't completely follow their advice. Because if you go back to chapter 4-5, you would find that his wife says, and in the morning, go and seek the king's advice. The next day, go. Haman couldn't even wait instantly had the gallows built, and instantly he runs down to the palace in the wee hours of the morning. So is it fortuitous that the king and his greatest advisors couldn't sleep this night? Is it fortuitous that one is determining to honor Mordecai and the other plans to humiliate and to kill Mordecai? Coincidence? I don't believe in coincidences. We've already talked about that. You're going to see why. Perfect. Haman's here. He can help. But it's interesting how he asked, how the king asked Haman for advice. Notice that he fails to give the name of the person or the man that he wants to have honored. Now, whether it was intentional on the king's part or not, I don't know. It doesn't indicate it to us. Nevertheless, there was a failure of the king to actually say to Haman who the man was that he wanted to honor. Isn't it interesting also that it was Haman who didn't advise the king as to what group of people he was planning on exterminating? He never gave him the name. He didn't say it was the Jews, because it's a real possibility that the king would have known even at that time that Mordecai was a Jew, and that there was many of his officials outside that were Jews. And so Haman has played this game with the king in saying, there's a group of people that are subversive and need to kind of be annihilated, king, and if you give me permission, I'll see to it that it's done. And so we see him refusing to give the name of the people he would like to have exterminated, and here we have the king at the same time failing to mention to Haman the name of the person who he wants to honor. And so hence begins the, many of you won't know what I'm talking about, the Abbott and Costello skit of who's on first. Okay? Those of you that remember that know what I'm talking about. That both of those guys are confused as to who's on first. No, he's on second. No, second. And back and forth they go. Their identity of who they're talking about actually standing on first base or second base is clearly becomes this funny scenario that they play out. It's the exact same thing that's occurring here. Neither of them know the other person who they're talking about. And so what goes through Haman's mind? Haman just jumps to the logical conclusion based upon the lust of his own heart. He has to be talking about me. I mean, who else has been honored such in this empire than me? I mean, I'm the only one invited to Esther's feast. I'm the second most powerful man. You put me there. As a matter of fact, king, you gave me your ring, that signet ring that seals law. And you gave me permission to make law, and you allowed it to be sealed. Who else possible is it that the king would honor rather than me? Assuming now that his ticket has been written, his ticket is stamped, Polar Express, here we come, we're on our way. At the end of it is, you know, the whole story of stamping those tickets. It's done, I'm on my way, nothing's going to stand in my way. Haman says, it's me. And what he says to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head the royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horses be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. And let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king delights to honor. Haman has so quickly jumped to conclusions based upon the self-centeredness and the self-satisfying desires that he has in it, that he has completely missed what he was even there for. He's like a kid in a toy store, the kid that saves for the BB gun all year, and is saved and saved and saved, and he walks into Toys R Us. I don't think they sell it. They're too liberal. So he's saving up for a sled. That was a bad illustration. I have to rewrite that. He was saving up for a sled, and he walks into Toys R Us, and he sees amazing things in the store. And this sled that he's been saving up all year for now kind of gets stuck to the back of his mind. Maybe I want this. Maybe I want this. Maybe I want that. Maybe I want that. That's exactly what's occurring here to Haman. He has completely forgotten why he had even run to the king that night to begin with in the early hours of the morning. Completely forgotten. Mordecai has completely slipped out of his mind, but how quickly is he reminded about Mordecai? Ruth. And the king just instantly loves Haman's idea. And then he says, then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horses you said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man of the king whom the king delights. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning with his head covered. How quickly our story has changed, like instantly. You talk about surprise. You understand that the king has made an order here. The king has ordered Haman to do something. He cannot refuse it. At this particular moment, Haman has absolutely no choice whatsoever than to honor what the king has ordered him to do. So instead of taking these robes and having somebody else put them on his shoulders, and taking this crown instead of having somebody else put it on his head, and bringing the horse out and having somebody help him onto the horse and him being led to it, he is doing just the opposite. Can you imagine walking through town as Haman? That should be me on that horse. That should be me up there. And it's not. And then to hear the people acclaim him, proclaim him, saying, what honor is being given to this guy? And the whole time thinking, that should have been me. It should have been me. After that's done, he hurries home with his head covered and in great mourning. He cries out to his wife earlier what he has done. Remember when he bellyached just hours before during that evening? He had bellyached to them about Mordecai not bowing down to him and the advice that they give him. Once again, he calls that same group of people together and he pours out to them all that has occurred. And what do they say? The light bulb is going on with these people. As dense as they were as counselors prior to this, the light bulb is going on with the family now. Listen to this, 13. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you'll not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. While they were talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Immediately upon hearing this entire story, immediately, these godless people actually have this epiphany at this point. Oh, wait a minute. It is a Jewish story. All the stories that we've heard about the Jewish God and the fact that nobody is able to stand before him has to become rushing back to them at this particular moment. And these dense counselors finally have some amazing insight from God himself, I believe, truth that was given to them by God. And I stopped in my studies this week and just very quickly thought about this. How much truth and hope would we as Christians today have within us if this began to permeate us? What the godless people said to Haman that night, if that truth began to permeate us, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Once again, God's name is not mentioned here, but intrinsic in all of this is the fact that the God of the Jews, the God of the Old Testament, if he is for them, nothing is going to come against them. And so we begin to look at it as Christians today, saying any calamity of life, whatever it may be, whatever it is not going to prevail against the God of heaven. So often we don't realize that. We let the godless people kind of come to that conclusion and fear and Zeresh and the wise men saying, you're in a world of hurt, bud. Because if God is for them, you're not going to be able to stand up against them. What an encouragement and hope that that gives us. Our God will endure no matter what calamity of life we are currently facing. I don't care what it is. Nothing is stronger than our God. Nothing. Haman's story. There's something else at work here, Haman. Or better put, I suppose, is someone else at work. Think about it. It just so happened, this is what's going on in his advisors' lives, talking to him that night. It just so happens that the king can't sleep tonight. It just so happens that the history of Mordecai is the passage that is read to him tonight. It just so happens that he wants to honor Mordecai at the very moment that you walk in there to have Mordecai killed. It just so happens that you walk in there at that very moment. It just so happens that the very prideful nature that you have within you welled up to that particular point. You couldn't even stay in bed yourself and had to run into him at that very moment. Now, that's not happenstance, Haman. This God of the Jewish people, he's for them. You're not going to be able to stand against them. There are no such things as coincidences. The subtle things of life is the orchestration of God in our lives for redemptive hope, folks. The subtle things of life, the insomnia here. This brings us really to this pivot point, if you will, of our entire book of Esther. For all of us that have really waited for this particular point and want to know, well, when does the hope begin? We're at that pivot point. Because prior to this pivot point, if you will, prior to it, Haman is exalted. And you have to keep in mind, I'm going to give a quick lesson here. I wish Hank was here this morning because he's the one that opened my eyes to some of this a couple years ago. I'm going to give you a literary lesson on how to read from this particular point on. But what we find at this particular point, this pivot point in the story, prior to it, Haman is exalted. He's joyous about everything. After the pivot point, he's grief-stricken. He's angry. Before it, Haman's wife and all of the friends, they proclaim victory. This is what's going to happen, man. You go have Mordecai killed, and you'll get your wishes. But after the pivot point, they're no longer saying that. They understand you're in a lot of trouble. You're in a world hurt. They're foretelling his demise. Before it, before the pivot point, Haman is executing Mordecai. After the pivot point, he exalts Mordecai. Before the pivot point, Haman is in total control of the situation. After the pivot point, one word told me that this is a change in it also. You notice the eunuchs, at the very last verse, the eunuchs from the king came and hurried Haman to the palace. Hurried him. Being taken away, he's whisked away. The picture becomes, Haman prior to this is in total control. After this pivot point, he ain't in control of anything. Even the eunuchs have picked him up and taken him out of there in a hurried manner. This is the entire turning point of the book. It's also the turning point of the inner story that we have in the book of Esther of this conflict between Mordecai and Haman. Because you do keep in mind, we've been looking at this for the last several weeks, that's not the major point of the book. It's the salvation of the Jews themselves is going to be the main point. And so what we see here, that this inner story is played out, but also we have the entire pivot point of the entire book of Esther. From this particular point, it's interesting, if you just want to take numbers, if you wanted to look at them, there's three feasts before the pivot point, and there's three feasts afterwards. It's interesting, just something totally innocuous, is that the city of Susa, found out, is mentioned 29 times before the pivot point and after the pivot point, 29 times. It once again brings us back to this idea that there is something going on at this particular time, the way the writer has laid it out. Prior, the upper hand goes to Haman. Afterwards, the upper hand is Mordecai. There always seems to be a corresponding point when you read books that are written this particular way. There's a corresponding point on one side of the pivot point and a corresponding point on the other. And that's what we see here. So what is our pivot point? What is it that is the pivot point of this book? I'm just going to let you think about that for 10 seconds. What is the pivot point of the book? Parting of the Red Sea? Lightning from heaven? Lazarus raised from the dead? What is this pivot point of the book of Esther? Look at verse 1, chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep. That is the pivot point of the entire book of Esther. On that night, he could not sleep. When you begin to look at this and you think, well, why? Why are you making such a big deal about that? We have to understand that the book of the Bible itself is written in different literary forms. Some of it is simply narrative. Some of it is simply telling stories. It's historical in nature. Some of it is poetry. A lot of it is poetry. And a lot of within that poetry is written in a particular form called chiastic structure. Now, this is what Hank had told me several years ago. I'd never heard the word before. It's called chiasms. It's writing a chiasm. Many times Emily probably could tell us a lot more about it than I could in creative writing and that kind of thing. But there's different types of writing on poetry even. You know, the ones where, you know, you write and you kind of rhyme it, you know, like food and wood. See, I'm no good at poetry, okay, and writing any of that stuff. They're spelled the same, but they don't sound the same, okay? But you know what I'm talking about. But then there's those poems that just, like, I can read Poe and Edgar Allan Poe, and it made no sense at all to me, okay? If you don't rhyme, I have no foggiest idea what you're talking about within it. But when I began to understand what Hank was saying several years ago about these chiasms, I began to look closer, and then one of the commentaries talked about the book of Esther as a chiasm. And so I did a little bit further research into it, and I'm absolutely convinced they are right. And he isn't the only one. Many of the commentaries just simply talk about the chiastic structure of this particular book. So let me just hopefully be able to explain this a little bit to us. A chiasm simply is a unique, well, I wrote a definition for it, and I'll go on to explain it. Do we have that up there? Yeah. A chiasm is a symmetrical or balanced arrangement of corresponding points to make emphasis and many times to point at a central point that is to be made. Now, stay with me, okay, on this. It basically is a unique way of repeating things. Now, I like the way that of Jesus repeating things in the New Testament. Truly, truly, I say unto you. Okay, that I can understand. I can follow that pretty quick. Okay, it's like, listen up, listen up. That makes sense. But if you're going to say it one time and then say it toward the end, I might have forgotten it by the time you got down to the end. Right? But that was one of the forms of writing that the Old Testament writers many times used. It's written in the New Testament even that way. One of the writers that I looked at believes that there's thousands of chiastic writings in the Scriptures for us to be able to understand the importance and the points that they're trying to make. And basically, it's this idea. If you have point A within a writing, you are going to repeat point A at the very end of the writing. Okay? So whatever the point was, you would write it at the top, and then you're going to finish it at the very end of this whole passage. At whatever point you're making, you're going to finish it with it. And you're going to make a second point. So let's call that point B. And you're going to make point B the second to the last emphasis. And then you're going to make a third point, and it will be the third from the last. And fourth, and the fourth, until you get to the very center of it, where really it points to the very major point that you have been trying to make. And so you would think that that center point is an amazing thing. You would think that that's got to be where the shoe really dropped, man. This is the parting of the Red Sea moments. But the chiastic writings of the Scriptures usually point us to the major point that they're trying to make. Now, when we begin to think about that, we begin to look at the Scripture of the book of Esther and say, is there a chiastic writing that's going on here? Well, there's another way for me to explain this, too. And this way, I can kind of, like, understand it. It's like when I make a sandwich at home, I'm going to tell you how to make a proper sandwich. Okay? The only way to make it is this. You take a piece of gluten-free bread. Okay? It has to be gluten-free now. Okay? Prior to that, it could have been Italian. But now it's a piece of gluten-free bread. And on that piece of bread, I put mayonnaise. Lots of mayonnaise. Okay? Because we're making a good sandwich here. All right. Then I put a piece of provolone cheese. Then I put a nice big piece of ham in the center of it. Then I put another piece of provolone cheese. Then I put more mayonnaise on that last piece of gluten-free bread, which is at the very bottom of it. So you hold the sandwich up. What is it that I'm really after? The ham in the center. That's what the telltale sign. What kind of sandwich is that? It's a ham sandwich. It's a telltale sign. But it ain't nothing without the rest of the stuff above it and below it in that proper order. So anybody wants to make a sandwich for me, please. My wife knows that. How many times have I checked both sides of the bread? Ooh, no mayonnaise on both sides of that bread. But the picture is that the point of that sandwich is at the very center of it, but it becomes really important when the outside are done pointing toward it. And so that's what a chiasm is. So we begin to look, is the book of Esther a chiasm? So I borrow from Inconspicuous Providence by Brian Gregory of this particular chiasm. I want to hurry a little bit here this morning, and so if you want to write these down and you can do some checking on me, you can. But you begin the book of Esther with a point of looking at Ahasuerus, the king's amazing empire. Remember the first couple of verses we looked at, 127 provinces and whatever? The very last couple of verses of the book of Esther talks about King Ahasuerus' empire. Exactly the same thing. They talk about it. Point B, there's two banquets held by the king. In verses 2 through 22 of chapter 1. The counterpoint B, going clear to the end of the book, back up from the conclusion of King Ahasuerus, looking at the two feasts for the Jews from chapter 9, verses 17 through 32. Point C, Esther is taken to the king, but conceals her identity. All the way down to the end of the story, back up 2 points. Esther comes before the king to request an additional day of battle in Susa because she professes to be a Jew. The third point in the book written here was she was concealing her identity. At the end of the story, the third point from the end is she's professing to be a Jew. Fourth point, description of Haman's stature. King Ahasuerus promotes Haman, son of Amadatha. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 2. Fourth point from the bottom on the other side, guess who is given great stature and his prominence is brought up? Mordecai. Look at fifth point, E, casting of lots. They've got to pick what day they are going to kill the Jews. Guess what the fifth point from the bottom is? The war on the 13th day of Adar, exactly what they pick. Turned a little bit, and ain't the Jews being destroyed, which is what it was supposed to be at the first. It was the Jews doing the destroying on that point. F, giving of a ring to Haman and Haman's letters. If you go to F on the other side of it, coming back up 6 points, giving the ring to Mordecai, gave it to Haman on the one side, Mordecai gets the ring. You're going to see how Mordecai is going to be given the exact position that Haman had. G, Esther's feast. We're almost to our point with the letter today. Esther's feast, chapter 5, 1 through 8. Go down to 6 from the bottom on the other side, find pretty much the same thing, Esther's second feast, which is going to be next week's message. H, seventh one, Haman's consultation with his associates and their optimism. I'll look at 6 where we're at today, 12 through 14, the other side of the pivot point. He's consulting once again with his associates, but there's no longer optimism. It's total pessimism. And we get to the pivot point. The king can't sleep. It all comes back to that particular moment. It's an amazing chiasm. Look at Joshua chapter 1, verses 5. You want to see a shorter one? Go home to this afternoon and begin to look at Joshua chapter 1, verses 5 through 9. And you're going to see, these words shall not depart from your mouth. And all that's going to be the center point of it. And it's going to back up and you're going to see God promising protection and growth to his people based in that particular chiasm. They're all throughout the scripture. And so we begin to look at that. So big deal, guy. Big deal. You uncovered a chiasm. What means that to us today? I began to think about that, and I wasn't even going to preach on it. And it struck me on Thursday. No, this is exciting to me. Because what is the chiasm points to the center point. What is that center point? Is that center point the parting of the Red Sea? Is it lightning and bolts from heaven? Is it raising somebody from the dead? Is it some amazing particular story that you can absolutely point back and say, this is a pivotal point in history from this particular moment? The king can't sleep. Really? You wrote an entire book, author, Esther? You wrote this entire book to bring out a main point that the king can't sleep? The point here is this. It is the inconspicuous, subtle workings of God that so many times the redemptive history of our lives hinges upon. The inconspicuous things. We think it's the great things of it. It's the time that we had that bullet whiz past our head from an errant shot from a deer rifle. Okay, and you think, that's a pivotal point in my life. I wasn't killed at that particular moment. What about the fact that you were running 5 minutes late to get to the hunting spot that day? That's an inconspicuous point. Did you miss an accident? Did God have you bump into somebody that you needed to speak to just because you ran a few minutes late? It's the inconspicuous subtleties of life that I believe that that's what we are seeing here. No great miracles. Think about all of the inconspicuous general stories that you know of the scriptures already. Think of the hatred of certain brothers. I'll change over to this one, Jake. I want you to think about the hatred of certain brothers for a particular brother that they had. And hatred was so great that they sold him into slavery. Happens all the time. You sell people off, you know, you don't like them. Back in those times, it was like, I can get some money for him. Who might just do that? Inconspicuous. Only people knew about it were the 11 brothers. But what happened from that? A people of God was saved because of brothers selling their hatred for him and selling him into slavery. Think about a ruler of the empire, of the world at the time, saying, you know what? I need to take a tax on people, and I need to know how many people are there. So I need to take a census. So guess what? Everybody, you go back to your hometowns, and you be given a census there. You be counted back there so we can get a tax. Okay, big deal, right? Let a young couple back to the city, and in that city was born a baby that was foretold thousands of years earlier to be born specifically in that particular city. Inconspicuous idea in the Caesar's mind. I need to take a census of people so everybody head home. Inconspicuous, subtle way that God's working. How about this? A man just simply walking on a beach, walking up to three strangers and says, you know what? I appreciate you fishing, but if you really want to fish for men, why don't you follow me? Inconspicuous. Nobody else knew it. Just the three guys heard him say that. And they decided there's something special about him. Maybe we need to check into this a little bit more. A subtle invitation simply to follow him. Or how about the imprisoning of certain quack preachers by the Romans? Stuck them in jail because they were irritating the priest. And so they stick them in the jail. And they decide, we're going to kill these guys because they really are just nothing more than insurgents here in our guy. They've got to be up to no good. And so we're just going to have them killed. And one of the teachers of the law stands up in front of them and says this, men of Israel, take care of what you're about to do with these men. In this present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or this undertaking is of man, it'll fail. But if it's of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God. Just a couple of quack preachers. Nothing earth-shattering going on. These guys just couldn't keep their mouth shut. That was all. Inconspicuous, subtle ways that God was working. They become the leaders of this new religion eventually. Or how about this? The common, almost everyday execution of a criminal on a cross in an outpost of the Roman Empire, on the very edge of their empire, just one of many, three criminals killed that particular day on a cross. Inconspicuous. Happens all the time. Nothing new. The city of Jerusalem didn't come to a standstill because there was going to be a crucifixion. Only a few people that knew the people were going to be out there and the Roman centurions. That's all that's there. It's inconspicuous.
but by the inconspicuous actions, the subtle actions of God, the redemption of the world today was had upon that cross. It's amazing when we begin to picture these little details, these little happenings in our lives. Listen to what Frederick Buechner, and I have no idea who he is other than currently still alive, a Presbyterian pastor, and he wrote this that I came across. Think about these details in our lives. Think about the invisible working that God is at work in the most insignificant things of our life. Insomnia, for goodness sakes. God is in the process. Listen to what Buechner says about these. There is no event so commonplace, but that God is present within it. Always hiddenly, always leaving you room to recognize him or not recognize him. But all the more fascinatingly because of that. All the more compellingly and hauntingly. Listen to your life. See it for the fathomless mystery it is. In the boredom of pain of it, no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way to the holy and hidden heart of it. Because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments. And life itself is grace. It's amazing when we begin to acknowledge and we begin to see that God is at work in every moment of our lives, the mundane of life. I mean, so often, housewives, okay, it's so mundane. Same thing, same thing, same thing. Okay, or you're stuck in that same dead-end job. You're putting that one bolt on that same piece of machinery, day in and day out and day in and day out. Is God in the midst of that mundane? Absolutely, he is in the midst of it all. We will have a greater appreciation, and I believe a zest for life when we begin to see the depth of the significance that God is involved in every one of those things. So when we have the vindictive boss and we're passed up for that promotion and we're upset about it, do we see God in it? When we have that work project that's delayed for whatever time frame, we bump into that crying stranger that you just can't turn away from at the mall, and I'm in such a hurry. The mundane thing that's going on. Or you dial the wrong number. Tammy's done this one time where she dialed the wrong number and got a hold of a lady who was in desperate need of encouragement over the phone. She was weeping to her 30 minutes later on a wrong number. Okay, it wasn't Tammy's fault. It was God in the process of changing that number at that particular time. The irritating serviceman that comes to your house to fix that stove. Okay, I should have been out of here a half hour ago. I got to get out to work. And he just wants to talk. God's in the process of it. Or how about failing tests when we have truly prepared for them? Some of you know what I'm talking about on that. Put our heart and our soul into the passing of this test, and beyond any control that we have whatsoever, we fail it. Is God in the midst of the mundane? Absolutely, he's in the midst of it. Who knows what God-ordained moments we may be faced with just today in the conversations that we may have? What is God lining up for all of eternity by our life's experiences, simply as a mother or a father or a friend or a student? The mundane things of life. What is God doing in the midst of it? Or how about the disappointments, the closed doors, the trying situations that God has brought us back? The delay of another 3 days before we get to North Carolina. the delay of it. Oh, Lord, seriously. He's in the midst of it. He's in the midst of these most days. There's no coincidences. There's no happenstances or chances in Christian's life. Nothing. We are totally under the supervision and the attendance of a sovereign God who is working out providentially his purpose in our lives in the subtle moments of everyday life. That's what we see here because of this. God is in the process of working things out because of a king's insomnia and a criminal being placed upon a cross in a Roman city of Providence. And being killed. God is in the midst of all of us. I want to leave us this morning by reading something I came across from J.C. Ryle.
And it'll be up on the screen so you can read along with me. It's amazing, his insight. I'm just going to read it and then the worship team can come up. Listen to what Ryle says about what I've talked about this morning. Just as the telescope and the microscope show us that there is order and design in all the works of God's hand, from the greatest planet down to the least insect, so does the Bible teach us that there is wisdom, order, and design in all the events of our daily life. There is no such thing as chance, luck, or accident in the Christian journey through this world. All is arranged and appointed by God, and all things are working together for the believer's good. Let us seek to have an abiding sense of God's hand in all that befalls us, if we profess to be believers in Jesus Christ. Let us strive to realize that a Father's hand is measuring out our daily portion and that our steps are ordered by Him. A daily practical faith of this kind is one grand secret of happiness and a mighty antidote against murmuring and discontent. We should try to feel in the day of trial and disappointment that all is right and all is well done. We should try to feel on the bed of sickness that there must be a needs be. We should say to ourselves, God could keep away from me these things if he thought fit, but he does not do so, and therefore they must be for my advantage. I will lie still and bear them patiently. I have an everlasting covenant ordered in all things and sure. What pleases God shall please me. It's amazing when we begin to understand that God is in the detail. And I did forget one illustration that I wanted to use, and I'm going to take the liberty. This is Pastor Appreciation Day, so you're supposed to be kind to me today, okay? I have at my house on the wall these. These are postcards, two postcards here. And it's an interesting story that's behind these postcards. These are postcards sent from my grandfather to his parents when he was 17, 18 years old. And the first one is dated January 13th, 1912. And it's interesting. As I began to look this over, and my parents, my dad found this in a bunch of stuff that was sent over from England after my granddad had passed away. And on the back of it, the very last thing, he talks about being a little disgruntled because he got bumped from a job. He was to be a steward on a boat. He got bumped for political reasons or because of favoritism or whatever it was. We're not quite sure. And the last thing that he put on this is, says, no luck with a Titanic SS as steward. No luck with the Titanic. January 13th, 1912. April 20th, 1912, he says, all still smiling here. Because you know what the story is. That in early April of 1912, the Titanic went down. My grandfather had gotten bumped off that trip. And so I just wanted to make an illustration that had that not occurred, Hannah, where are you? Abby? Maddie? Boo? Stand up. Aaron? Stand up. And little Silas. None of them. None of them, including myself standing here, would be here today if the subtle decision wasn't made by the people of the Titanic to bump my grandfather out of a job. Amazing, isn't it? Thank you, Lord. Thank you very much. It's an amazing picture when we were able to grasp the reality of God is in those subtle moments. He's in the moments of insomnia. And he's in the moments of losing a steward's job on the Titanic.